Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 5th of November, these are our main stories. Arab foreign ministers meeting in Jordan have told the US Secretary of State there must be an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The UN says one of its schools in the Jabalia camp was hit by an airstrike. The army in Guinea says the former military ruler Moussa Dadis Camara is back in prison, hours after he was freed in an armed assault. Also in this podcast...
You need to get rid of that, what we call angular momentum, that rotation. And the way these baby stars do it is by ejecting material from both ends. And so there's the analogy with the babies, if you like. They burp occasionally and they throw material out.
The problem for baby stars, growing up. Israel is committing war crimes. That's what the Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi told the American Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Saturday as he toured the region, trying to stop the war between Hamas and Israel getting even worse. Mr. Safadi made those remarks in Arabic. In English, he was only a little less stark.
We cannot allow this war to undermine all that has been done to bring about just peace to the region. With every missile unleashed on Gaza, with every killing of a Palestinian child, the whole region is sinking in a sea of hatred that will define generations to come.
It was striking language coming from Jordan, which was the second Arab state after Egypt to sign a peace deal with Israel. Mr. Blinken met Mr. Safadi and other Arab foreign ministers in Amman. He went there from Israel, where the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said on Friday he would not agree to a pause in his country's attacks on Gaza until all Israeli hostages were released. But the Arab foreign ministers told Mr. Blinken there must be an immediate cessation of hostilities. Mr. Blinken said while it was important to make sure the kind of attack that Hamas unleashed 4 weeks ago did not happen again, Israel must minimise civilian casualties. And without a humanitarian pause, that wasn't possible.
We believe pauses can be a critical mechanism for protecting civilians, for getting aid in, for getting foreign nationals out, while still enabling Israel to achieve its objective, to defeat Hamas. Yesterday I spoke in depth with Israeli leaders about how, when, and where such arrangements could be implemented and what needs to be done to make them possible. Today, regional partners discuss many of these same questions.
Our correspondent, Anthony Zerker, is travelling with Mr. Blinken and told us more.
I think what he's trying to do is find some middle ground between what these Arab counterparts are insisting, which is a full ceasefire, and what the Israelis want to do, which is continue to prosecute their war against Hamas with no pauses whatsoever. Of course, that's a difficult middle ground because his suggestions of humanitarian pauses have been rejected by both sides. But he's trying to make the case that humanitarian pauses would allow aid to reach the Gazans who need it the most, and also perhaps facilitate the release of hostages, while a complete ceasefire would allow Hamas to regroup and conduct more military operations against the Israelis in the future. So he's walking a fine line here, but at least at the moment, he's caught in a pincher between these two sides.
And is the future of Gaza being addressed already, including the Arab attitude to Hamas, whatever happens when this conflict finally ends?
Well, it's interesting. Antony Blinken has been saying from the start that all the parties in the region need to think about day two, not just what's happening right now with the conflict, but a way to ensure a lasting and durable peace going forward. And he talked about that again on Saturday with his Arab partners. But that was something that the Jordanian minister dismissed rather quickly when asked about it. He said that he has to focus on what is going on right now and ending the conflict right now, and that they can address the situation for the Gazans after that is taken care of, because he said they don't even know what kind of condition Gaza will be in after Israel concludes its military campaign. So it's pointless to think about what role Hamas would play in Gaza, for instance, and what kind of long-term solution there could be. Although all the parties in the press conference this evening did agree that ultimately peace in the Middle East is going to hinge on a two-state solution for the Palestinians, giving them their own state separate from the Israelis.
And in concrete terms, while this conflict goes on, Mr. Blinken spoke about extending aid delivery through the Rafah crossing. Do you think there's going to be anything concrete coming out of this meeting in terms of that?
Well, nothing has been publicly announced, certainly. Earlier on Saturday, State Department officials did say that they could see as many as 500 or 600 trucks eventually going through that crossing. It all depends on improving the ability of the humanitarian assistance individuals on the ground there to distribute the aid. It's not so much getting the trucks to the border, but getting them through the border and getting the people who need them. So it's the American view that humanitarian aid through that crossing can be ramped up, that it is something that the Israelis will support. But right now, it's a matter of trying to figure out a way to, once those trucks get in there, distributing the aid effectively.
Anthony Zerker. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNRWA, said one of its schools housing displaced civilians in Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza was hit by a strike. The Hamas-run health ministry said at least 15 people were killed, with dozens more wounded. Maisa lives near the school. She told the BBC she'd run to the scene when she heard it had been hit and described what she found.
People used to go there to be safe. They left their houses because the houses were destroyed, and they went to the safe place. But unfortunately, they were attacked, and the strike hit many tens of people, children, women, men. They were just standing in the square because the rooms of this school is not enough for the people. Because my relatives are there, I want to see them, that they're still alive. I heard the explosion, and there was a radio, and someone told me that the El Fakhoura school has been attacked. I went to, on foot. I walked 20 minutes to reach them in a critical, serious situation in the streets. I was very afraid. I was in the middle of the street when the people started to run away. Of course, I ran away also. It was horrible. We are civilians. We are simple people. We need only peace. We want to stop these massacres. We want everyone, all the Arab, Europe, USA, everyone to ask Israel just to stop killing people.
UNRWA's Juliet Tuma told the BBC that thousands of people were sheltering at the Al Fakhoura school in the north of the territory.
Among the casualties, among those killed, are also believed to be children. The school got a hit in its courtyard where there were tents for displaced families. And then another hit came next to a wall of the school where women were baking bread.
Israel said the facility had been near an exchange of fire with Hamas fighters who were deploying mortars. I got more details from our correspondent Paul Adams in Jerusalem.
I think that episode that you just described is really indicative of the reality of life in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and especially in Gaza City and the surrounding areas at the moment, because that is a war zone. The entire area is now a war zone. No aid is getting in there, and there are, by some estimates, as many as 300,000 to 400,000 civilians who have either have not been able to, or have chosen to, or have not been able to get out and to obey those Israeli instructions to move to the south. And as a result, they find themselves in the middle of active fighting. And it is, I'm afraid, utterly inevitable that any civilians who are still in that area will be extremely vulnerable to incidents just like this. We know that Israeli forces are within a few minutes' drive of the Shifa hospital, where, again, we think that there are thousands of Palestinian civilians sheltering. So the longer this phase of the campaign goes on, and in the absence of any meaningful humanitarian pauses, I'm afraid we're going to have more of this. One thing I should point out is that the Israelis said that they were going to open the road, the main north-south road, for about 3 hours to allow civilians to leave. I don't know how many people tried to do that, but the Israelis said that they were actually fired on by Hamas gunmen in that area in what the Israelis describe as an effort to try and prevent civilians from leaving. So that's another indication of the complexity of the situation there in the northern Gaza Strip at the moment.
Well, that's the north of the Gaza Strip. So what's happening in the south? We've had this report from our correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf in Khan Yunis.
The people saying that the road leads to the southern part is completely damaged and there is no access for cars to move. Well, few cars, hundreds of cars arrived to the area and they couldn't move to the south. Very few people who managed to get out of the car and walk. And we understand there was Israeli checkpoint with tanks in the area and they were checking people's ID and then they processed some of the people there. Why people are not leaving? About 500,000 people still in Gaza City and the north, because they believe, if you ask any Palestinians, they say no place is safe. And the Israelis keep targeting places in the so-called safe area where I am standing here in Khan Yunis. Yesterday I went to cover aftermath of an airstrike. And people were digging with their hands under the rubble to get 5 kids under the a building was taken down. 15 people were killed. Also, the city of Khan Yunis, which now accommodate like half of the population, over 1 million people here, there is no space in the streets. People are sleeping in the streets, even in the hospital here in Khan Yunis, Nasser Hospital. Thousands of people are taking the hospital as a shelter. They are sleeping on the ground. They don't have a place to go. In fact, some, when the road was open at the beginning of the Israeli ground operation, some who were displaced and they live in Khan Yunis, they go back to Gaza City.
Rushdie Abu Alouf in Khan Yunis. Thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators marched in Washington and in London on Saturday. Britain and other countries have also seen rising numbers of both anti-Semitic and Islamophobic attacks. Around a decade or so ago, here in the UK, two women, Laura Marks, who's Jewish, and Julie Siddiqui, who's Muslim, co-founded the network Nisa Nashim to bring together women from both communities to lead outreach and interfaith projects in their local area. Let's hear from them. First, Julie Siddiqui.
We've always put friendship at the heart of it and actually said to people, you know, don't create the friendship just based on what's happening in that part of the world. And of course, at the moment, we're all very, very live to it. Stuff like this travels and it really matters to both of these communities in particular. I'm seeing a mixed picture, actually. I'm seeing people who, through Nisa Nashim and in other spaces, who thought they had friendship and thought they had the trust between each other, but this situation is very, very testing for them. I've also seen, though, other people who perhaps haven't ever really even delved into this kind of work actually saying to me, it's really interesting to me that you're doing this right now, you're in the ring, you're in the trenches, as it were, trying to keep hold of these relationships. I'd really like to know more about that, and maybe it's something I want to get more information about. So I think for me, actually, the little glimmers of hope, the connections that people have with each other, the hand-holding, all of that is still happening despite how difficult it is.
There is a lot of fear in the Jewish community and the levels of hate towards Israel, which spill over so easily into anti-Semitism, do really genuinely frighten people. And I'm a fifth generation British Jew. Even I'm thinking this just doesn't feel comfortable. This doesn't feel right. So the chanting, which we are hearing way too much of, which is full of hate very often, I really wish people could understand how this stuff is received and that we could just put ourselves a little bit into people's shoes.
I take exception, actually, to people in government even who are calling all of these marches hate marches, because I don't believe that's very helpful to use that kind of language. I know people that go to these kinds of marches. How do we navigate all of that? Well, it feels almost impossible sometimes, frankly, when you're talking about the numbers that we're talking about. But there's no doubt the fear that's created in the Jewish community, for me, is not okay. Of course it's not okay. That then comes down to what? Education. It comes down to people meeting each other. You know, when you've got good people who are saying very bad things, something has gone wrong there somewhere. And we need that education and that understanding, which can only actually happen when people meet each other.
Julie Siddiqui and Laura Marks. Other news now, and if you could go back 4.6 billion years and take a picture of our sun in its infancy, what would it look like? Well, thanks to images captured by NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, we now have an idea, and the image of the baby star in the constellation of Orion is striking. It's thought to be just 50,000 years old, a newborn compared to our sun. Mark McCorkran is a senior advisor for science and exploration at the European Space Agency, and he's been studying this baby star since 1993. Rebecca Kesby asked him how a baby sun becomes an adult.
It's got to take in material, it's got to feed, and it does that from a cloud of gas and dust surrounding it. But it actually also has to get rid of some material. And the reason for that is that these clouds are spinning, and the more they contract down, the more they get smaller, they spin faster, like an ice skater does when they pull their arms in. And you need to get rid of that, what we call angular momentum, that rotation. And the way these baby stars do it is by ejecting material from both ends. And so there's the analogy with the babies, if you like. They burp occasionally and they throw material out. That material's spinning, but it's in the form of a linear jet that's ejected out. And that's what we see in these images from the James Webb Space Telescope.
I mean, there's always mind-bending numbers when it comes to space and the age of things. What does this one tell us about our own sun and indeed life?
Well, that's the very early phase that we're seeing here. So that's as it's still growing. And this star is probably about half the size of our sun today, but it could get up to be roughly the size of our sun. But it's this ejection of this material out into space that we're really fascinated by, because that dominates everything in these early phases. We know there's some chemistry there going on as well. So maybe we'll see some molecules that could get incorporated into planets in the next few million years. But this is just, you know, really about those very earliest phases. How do you feed and get rid of that angular momentum simultaneously? It's quite close to the Horsehead Nebula, which is in the belt of Orion. So in the wintertime now, if you look out in the evening time, you'll see Orion standing in the sky, has this belt across the middle and the sword hanging below it. And it's just off to the left end of the leftmost star there. What we see is a line of glowing hydrogen gas. We only see it in the infrared, so you couldn't see it with your naked eye. We see it going out symmetrically on both sides and spanning a line which is about a couple of light years wide. So it's a very big structure from a very small star.
Mark McCorkran talking there to Rebecca Kesby. Still to come.
Britain's loneliest sheep is lonely no more. She has lots of friends here. Major operation.
How five farmers rescued a sheep named Fiona. An Australian Prime Minister is visiting China. Anthony Albanese arrived in Shanghai on Saturday in a trip that has been described as an ice-breaking state visit. It comes at a time of growing military ties between Australia and the US. The Biden administration is also starting to rearm Taiwan and is retraining its military, fearful that the island is woefully unprepared for the challenge from China. Our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes sent us this report from Taiwan.
On a beach on Taiwan's west coast, heavily armed troops are repelling an attempted landing by enemy forces. The invading troops are met by a hail of machine gun and cannon fire. Apache helicopter gunships hover overhead.
A lot of noise, a lot of smoke, a lot of gunfire. In many ways, it's a big show, but it's a show with a purpose, to show Taiwan and the world that they are prepared to fight and they are prepared to repel any attempt by the Chinese to land here.
The trouble is, they aren't ready. Every day, Chinese ships and planes probe Taiwan's airspace. On November the 1st, 43 Chinese aircraft and 7 naval ships crossed the median line that divides the Taiwan Strait. This used to be a rare occurrence. Now it happens every day. But ask any military expert on this side of the straits, and they'll tell you Taiwan is woefully ill-prepared to face down China's threat. Military conscripts get just 4 months training, and most describe it as little more than a summer camp.
But yeah, it's very disorganized. It's super disorganized. It doesn't feel like a military, it feels like a summer camp. That's what everybody gets.
This young man did his 4 months training during the COVID pandemic.
There's a test, there's a fitness test. So you have to run 3K for the fitness test. But we ran zero times before the test. I don't even know how I would, like, how, like, combat works. Nothing. I learned nothing, yeah.
From next year, Military conscripts will have to serve a year, but that's still well short of what they do in Korea and far less than Israel. But the biggest problem for Taiwan's military is its isolation. Since 1979, when the US broke relations, Washington has continued to sell weapons to Taiwan, but there has been almost no military-to-military cooperation. According to Lai Yi-Ching, who's the director of the Prospect Foundation think tank in Taipei, Taiwan's ground forces, their training, doctrine, tactics, and battlefield systems are all 50 years out of date.
Right after 1979, the U.S.-Taiwan cut-out relationship, but also at the same time the defense treaty no longer exists, so that our services are starting to have a experience different kind of the isolations. And the Army experienced the most isolations, so that they stuck in the Vietnam era of the military doctrine.
In Washington, deep concern about Taiwan's preparedness has prompted a quiet but significant shift. There are once again U.S. military trainers on the ground here in Taiwan. And in August, President Joe Biden signed off on an $80 million military package for Taiwan. 80 million is small beer in military terms, but it came from something called the Foreign Military Financing Program. It's a program that is usually reserved for America's closest allies.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. Just hours after an apparent jailbreak, a former military leader of Guinea is now back in prison. Early on Saturday, an armed group stormed a prison in the capital, Conakry, and took Moussa Dadis Camara and three others. In the early hours of Saturday, people woke up to the sound of gunfire as the heavily armed men attacked the prison, prompting the authorities to launch a nationwide manhunt. Those taken are currently on trial for their alleged roles in the deaths of more than 150 people in a protest back in 2009. The military now says that Captain Camara has been recaptured. Our West Africa correspondent, Myeni Jones, began by telling me that the military says the escape was an attempt to sabotage the country's current leadership.
They say that they were trying to implement some reforms and that this was an attempt to thwart that. It's not exactly clear how. Mr. Camara's lawyer, though, has been at pains to stress that his client wasn't involved in today's abduction, that he had nothing to do with it. He was taken against his will. He says that he was kidnapped, that he has trust in the Guinean judicial system, so there's no way he would try and escape prison. So that's laid out a bit of doubt there as to whether Mr. Camara knew he was going to be abducted today and wasn't involved in all of this. But I think overall what this highlights is just what a fragile state Guinea is in at the moment. More than a couple of years since it's had its last coup, it's showing some sort of cracks within its ranks, because as the Minister of Justice was saying on local radio earlier today, they need to investigate how Mr. Camara and these three other men, how they were able to escape the prison given how heavily protected it is.
Myeni Jones. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says the war between Israel and Hamas is taking away the focus from the conflict in his country. He was speaking at a news conference in Kyiv with the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, reports.
The focus of President Zelensky's talks with Ursula von der Leyen was on progress towards getting formal EU accession talks approved. From what the Commission boss said, that is going well. The more crucial situation regarding Ukraine's fight against Russian invaders seems less positive. Mr. Zelensky denied fighting had reached a stalemate, despite a recent assessment to this effect by Ukraine's top general. But he acknowledged that people were tired. Mr. Zelensky also denied he was coming under pressure to consider peace talks with Russia, following a report in the US media. His country would not sit down with Moscow to work out what to give it, he stressed. What Ukraine needed, he said, was to work more with allies on air defence and freeing up skies from Russian control to give its military the chance to liberate territory. A concerted counteroffensive by Ukraine since the summer has failed to deliver decisive gains against entrenched Russian defences. And political wranglings in the United States about military aid only complicates the picture for Kyiv.
Danny Eberhard. A ewe dubbed Britain's loneliest sheep has been rescued from a remote shore in the Scottish Highlands. She'd been stranded at the foot of cliffs on the Cromartie Firth for at least 2 years, but a group of five farmers decided to intervene, as Charlotte Reid reports.
The sheep was first spotted on the shoreline in 2021 by a kayaker. And on a recent return trip to the same spot, she said she was shocked to discover that the sheep was still stuck there and began a campaign pleading for someone to help. After hearing about their plight in the media, five farmers decided they would lead a rescue mission.
Half an hour tail, I'll get a wee lift. Right, there we go.
They managed to drag the ewe, which they've called Fiona, up a steep slope and back to safety.
Britain's loneliest sheep is lonely no more. She has lots of friends here. Major operation.
The efforts were organised by Cammie Wilson, a sheep shearer. The Scottish SPCA were also in attendance. They say Fiona is in good health, but her overgrown fleece needs to be dealt with. Apparently a job for tomorrow, according to those who rescued her.
Charlotte Reed. They live in your bed, crawl out at night and drink your blood while you sleep. So there is understandable concern at reports of bed bug infestations in major European cities like Paris and London. But even for those who've never been bitten, it seems the very mention of the creatures is enough to make some people feel itchy and stressed. And Stephanie Prentice told Oliver Conway why.
I mean, I'm itchy and stressed even thinking about this, but the BBC has been speaking to some psychologists about it. It's all about the brain's ability to connect a thought or a mental image with a physical sensation, a kind of mind-body connection. So bed bugs, for anyone that's ever had them, they're very itchy, they get red, they swell up. And of course, there's this idea of something feeding on you while you sleep that just disgusts people. So anyone that's had an infestation before or even been bitten by any insect has got the propensity to imagine how that would feel. So in terms of the process, you think about the bug and the bite, the brain starts gearing up, it's activating past memories or mental images, sparking neural pathways, and then comes those itchy, sort of crawly skin sensations. It happens very quickly. It's called psychogenic itching, which is an itch with no real cause. And I mean, it kind of goes without saying, but the more someone feels fear or disgust about an idea, like a bed bug bite, the more likely it is to happen.
And bed bug anxiety is on the rise, it seems.
It is. I mean, bed bugs are no joke. If you've got them, they're really hard to get rid of. Some scientists say they actually survived the extinction event that killed the dinosaurs. And they primarily live in what people see as a safe space. It's your bedroom. So not wanting to deal with them, that's legitimate fear. But the recent boom in cases, that's been covered widely in European media at least, and it's caused a spike in anxiety around the idea of them. That's according to those psychologists the BBC's been speaking to. So people are being confronted with just the idea of them more. Now, one expert did say anyone that runs at what they call a high threat alert system or who may be tired or run down, they'll be more impacted as a sort of survival instinct, if you will, kicks in. So the part of the brain that would light up in response to a real threat will do so as if the thing is actually there. It's also a very personal experience. So if it triggers a past trauma from a similar experience where someone maybe felt fear or disgust or shame, that will exacerbate it too. What experts have said is that trying to stay calm is really the only thing that will lessen that anxiety and maybe stop those itchy feelings.
All I can say is yuck. That was Stephanie Prentice there. And let's return to our main news, the fighting in Gaza. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has reported on the Israeli and Palestinian conflict for decades. He's now in Jerusalem covering the current conflict. Here's what he makes of this war, 4 weeks on from the Hamas attack of October the 7th.
One of the first things to know about the war here is that everyone, and I mean everyone, is dealing with incomplete information. But we do know a few things that help to understand a war that could be in its early stages and might get much worse. One, the shock and anger that is powering Israel's response to the Hamas attacks of the 7th of October. Avraham Berg, now a writer, once Speaker of Parliament during the peace process years of the 1990s, says Israelis are feeling as insecure as they were in the years immediately after the Holocaust.
We, the Jews, we believe that the state of Israel is the best immune system and protective system versus Jewish history. No more pogroms, no more Holocaust, no more mass murderers. And all of a sudden, all of it is back. So people sentimentally and emotionally are back to 45, 48.
And Palestinians are having flashbacks to their own history. The establishment of the Israeli state in 1948 destroyed their society in Palestine, an event Palestinians call the catastrophe, al-Nakba. More than 700,000 of them were expelled or fled at the hands of Israeli forces. A good proportion ended up in refugee camps in Gaza, where their descendants are sheltering and being killed by Israeli airstrikes. Palestinians say Israel is trying to create a second Nakba. Another point that we do know is that Israelis believe the only way to be safe is to destroy Hamas and its junior partner in Gaza, Islamic Jihad. In the chaos of the 7th of October, Noam Tibon, a retired Israeli general, had a text from his son saying that Hamas gunmen were inside their kibbutz, Nachal Oz, and he was in the safe room with his wife and two young daughters. General Tibon mounted his own successful rescue operation to save them, along with dozens of their neighbours. He picked up an assault rifle and a helmet from a dead Israeli officer and joined the fight with a squad of soldiers he'd mustered from assorted stragglers. Tibon, like so many other Israelis, has hardened his heart.
Gaza is going to suffer because no nation will agree that they will, your neighbor will slaughter babies, women, old people. Yes, it's ugly what's going on in Gaza today, but we have no choices.
One more absolute certainty. Palestinians in Gaza are going through hell. In many visits over more than 30 years, I've always been impressed with the way the human spirit flourished in Gaza, despite the terrible privations people suffered. And what's happening now would test anyone to breaking point. Naswa is a humanitarian worker, but she's desperately worried that she can't even provide for her own daughters.
I have the youngest, she's 4 years old, and she's showing severe symptoms of stress and fear, like ripping her hair off and scratching her thighs until they bleed. My mission in life has become to keep them alive. I don't have the luxury to think about their mental health.
I've just been sent some videos made by Marwan Abu Sada, a surgeon at Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. He takes us through overcrowded wards filled with patients. He points out a boy with no visitors whose family are all dead. A small child sleeps in a cot with a fresh bandage on the stump of an amputated leg. The doctor opens the doors on theatres with operations in full swing. Says hello to exhausted colleagues. They're taking it day by day. No one knows how this will finish.
Jeremy Bowen. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Gabriel O'Regan and the producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Wenn Sie diesen Podcast hören, wissen Sie bereits, wie wichtig es ist, Fragen zu stellen. Bei Aramco helfen uns unsere Fragen, eine bessere Zukunft zu gestalten. Wie können wir die Kraftstoffe von morgen zur Verfügung stellen? Wie können wir die Ressourcen von heute zum Treibstoff für unsere gemeinsame Zukunft machen? Wie können wir eine Welt mit Energie versorgen, die sich keinen Ausfall leisten kann? Wie können wir Neugier säen und so Ideenreichtum ernten? Mehr zu Innovationen, die uns voranbringen, aramco.com/das Wie treibt uns an.